that the god of Yule's understanding would find some way for Yule to make things right. And then he could let the despicable feelings go, instead of keeping them down with doers. But Gately couldn't connect the impulse to speak with actual speech still. He settled for trying to reach his left hand across and pat Yule's hand on the railing. But his own breadth was too far to reach across, and then the white ceiling came all the way down and made everything white. He seemed to sort of sleep. He fever-dreamed of dark, writhing storm clouds writhing darkly and screaming on down the beach at Beverly, Massachusetts, the winds increasing over his head until Herman the polyurethane vacuole burst from the force, leaving a ragged and hailing maw that tugged at Gately's XXL Dr. Denton's. A blue-stuffed brontosaurus was sucked upward out of the crib and disappeared into the maw, spinning. His mother was getting the shit beaten out of her by a man with a shepherd's crook in the kitchen and couldn't hear Gately's frantic cries for help. He broke through the crib's bars with his head and went to the front door and ran outside. The black clouds up the beach lowered and roiled, funneling sand, and as Gately watched, he saw a tornado snout emerge from the clouds and slowly lower. It looked as if the clouds were either giving birth or taking a shit. Gately ran across the beach to the water to escape the tornado. He ran through the crazed breakers to deep warm water and submerged himself and stayed under until he ran out of breath. It was now no longer clear if he was Little Bimmy or the grown man Don. He kept coming up briefly for a great sucking breath and then going back under where it was warm and still. The tornado stayed in one place on the beach, bulging and receding, screaming like a jet. It's opening a breathing maw, lightning coming off the funnel cloud like hair. He could hear the tiny, tattered sounds of his mother calling his name. The tornado was right by the beach house, and the whole house trembled. His mother came out the front door, wild-haired and holding a bloody Ginsu knife, calling his name. Gately tried to call for her to come into the deep water with him, but even he couldn't hear his calls against the scream of the storm. She dropped the knife and held her head as the funnel pointed its pointy maw her way. The beach house exploded, and his mother flew through the air toward the funnel's intake, arms and legs threshing as if swimming in wind. She vanished into the maw and was pulled, spinning, up into the tornado's vortex. Shingles and boards followed her. No sign of the shepherd's crook of the man who'd hurt her. Gately's right lung burned horribly. He saw his mother for the last time when lightning lit up the funnel's cone. She was whirling around and around like something in a drain, rising, seeming to swim, bluely backlit. The burst of lightning was the white of the sunlit room when he came up for air and opened his eyes. His mother's tiny rotating imago faded against the ceiling. What seemed like heavy breathing was him trying to scream. The skinny bed's sheets were soaked, and he needed to piss something bad. It was daytime, and his right side was in no way numb, and he was immediately nostalgic for the warm cement feeling of when it was numb. Tiny Yule was gone. His every pulse was an assault on his right side. He didn't think he could stand it for even another second. He didn't know what would happen, but he didn't think he could stand it. Later, somebody, who was either Joelle Van D or a St. E's nurse in a UHID veil, was running a cold washcloth over his face. His face was so big it took some time to cover it all. It seemed too tender a touch on the cloth for a nurse. But then Gately heard the clink of IV bottles being changed or RN-ishly messed with somewhere overhead behind him. He was unable to ask about changing the sheets or going to the bathroom. Sometime after the veiled lady left, he just gave up and let the piss go. And instead of feeling wet heat, he heard the rising metallic sound of something filling up somewhere near the bed. He couldn't move to lift the covers and see what he was hooked up to. The blinds were up, and the room was so bright white in the sunlight, everything looked bleached and boiled. The guy with either the square head or the box on his head had been taken off someplace. His bed unmade and one crib railing down. There were no ghostish figures or figures in mist. The hallway was no brighter than the room, and Gately couldn't see any shadows of anybody in a hat. He didn't even know if last night had been real. The pain kept making his lids flutter. He hadn't cried over pain since he was 4. His last thought before letting his lids stay shut against the brutal white of the room was that he'd maybe been castrated, which is how he'd always heard the term catheterized. He could smell rubbing alcohol and a kind of vitamin stink, and himself. At some point, a probably real Pat Mottisian came in and got her hair in his eye when she kissed his cheek and told him if he could just hang in and concentrate on getting well, everything would be fine. That everything at the house was back to normal, more or less, and essentially fine. That she was so sorry he'd had to handle a situation like that alone, without support or counsel, and that she realized full well Lentz and the Canadian thugs hadn't given him enough time to call anybody. That he'd done the very best he could with what he'd had to work with, and had nothing to feel horrid about, to let it go. That the violence hadn't been relapse-type thrill-seeking violence, but simply doing the best he could at that moment and trying to stand up for himself and for a resident of the house. Pat Mottisian was dressed as usual entirely in black, but formally, as in for taking somebody to court, and her formal wear looked like a Mexican widow's. She really had said the words thug and horrid. She said not to worry. The house was a community, and it took care of its own. She kept asking if he was sleepy. Her hair's red was a different and less radiant red than the red of Joelle Van D's hair. The left side of her face was very kind. Gately had very little understanding of what she was talking about. He was kind of surprised the finest hadn't come calling already. Pat didn't know about the remorseless assistant district attorney, or the suffocated nook. Gately tried hard to share openly about the wreckage of his past, but some issues still seemed suicidal to share about. Pat said that Gately was showing tremendous humility and willingness, sticking to his resolution about nothing stronger than non-narcotic painkillers, but that she hoped he'd remember that he wasn't in charge of anything except putting himself in his higher power's hands and following the dictates of his heart. That codeine, or maybe Percocet, or maybe even Demerol,
341.
Wouldn't be a relapse, unless his heart of hearts that knew his motives thought it would be. Her red hair was down, and looked uncombed, and mashed in on the side. She looked frazzled. Gately wanted very much to ask Pat about the legal fallout of the other night's thug fracas. He realized she kept asking if he was sleepy because his attempts to speak looked like yawns. His inability to still speak was like speechlessness in bad dreams, airless and hellish, horrid. What made the whole interface with Pat M. possibly unreal was that right at the end, for no reason, Pat M. burst into tears, and for no reason Gately got so embarrassed he pretended to pass out and slept again. Almost certainly dreamed and unreal was the interval when Gately came up with a start and saw Mrs. Lopate, the objet d'art from the shed that they come and install next to the Ennett House viewer some days, sitting there in a gunmetal wheelchair, face contorted, head cocked, hair stringy, looking not at him, but more like seemingly at whatever array of IV bottles and signifying monitors hung above and behind his big crib. So not speaking or even looking at him, but still, in some sense, being there with him, somehow. Even though there was no way she could have really been there, it was the first time Gately realized that the catatonic Mrs. L. had been the same lady he'd seen touching the tree in Number 5's front lawn late at night, some nights, when he'd first come on staff. That they were the same person, and that this realization was real even though the lady's presence in the room was not, the complexities of which made his eyes roll up in his head again as he passed back out again. Then at some later point, Joelle Van Dyne was sitting in a chair just outside the railing of the bed, veiled, wearing sweatpants and a sweater that was starting to unravel, in a pink-bordered veil, not saying anything, probably looking at him, probably thinking he was unconscious with his eyes open, or delirious with Noxzema. The whole right side of himself hurt so bad, each breath was like a hard decision. He wanted to cry like a small child. The girl's silence and the blackness of her veil frightened him after a while, and he wished he could ask her to come back later. Nobody'd offered him anything to eat, but he wasn't hungry. There were IV tubes going into the backs of both hands and the crook of his left elbow. Other tubing exited him lower down. He didn't want to know. He kept trying to ask his heart if just codeine would be a relapse, according to the heart, but his heart was declining to comment. Then at some point, In-House alum and senior counselor Calvin Thrust came roaring in and pulled up a chair and straddled it backwards like a slow tease stripper, slumping and draping his arms over the back of the chair, gesturing with an unlit Rodney as he spoke. He told Gately that, man, he looked like shit, something heavy it fell on. But he told Gately he should get a gander of the other guys, the Nooks and Polynesian wear. Thrust and the house manager had got there before EMPHH security could drag the finest away from issuing midnight street-side citations down on Com Ave, he told Gately. Lance and Green and Alfonso Perez Carbo had dragged-slashed-carried the passed-out Gately inside and laid him on the black vinyl couch in Pat's office, where Gately had come to, and told them, ixnay on the ambulance-a, and to please wake him up in 5 more minutes, and then passed out for serious real. Perez Carbo seemed like he'd suffered a mild intestinal hernia from dragging, carrying Gately, but he was being a man about it, and had refused codeine downstairs at the ER, and was expressing gratitude for the growth experience, and the thoracic lump was receding nicely. Calvin Thrust's breath smelled of smoke and old scrambled eggs. Gately had once seen a cheap bootleg cartridge of a young Calvin Thrust having sex with a lady with only one arm on what looked like a crude homemade trapeze. The cartridge's lighting and production values had been real low quality, and Gately had been in and out of a Demerol nod, but he was 98% sure it had been the young Calvin Thrust. Calvin Thrust said how, right there, over Gately's unconscious form in the office, Randy Lentz had begun womaning right off how, of course, he, Randy Lentz, was going to somehow get blamed for Gately and the Nooks getting fucked up, and why didn't they just get it over with and give him the administrative shoe right now without going through the sham motions of deliberating? Bruce Green had ran Lentz up against Pat's cabinets and shaken him like a margarita, but refused to rat out Lentz or say why irate Canadians might think a specimen as dickless as Lentz might have demapped their friend. The matter was under investigation, but Thrust confessed to a certain admiration for Green's refusal to eat cheese. Brucey G. had suffered a broken nose in the beef, and now had a terrific set of twin shiners. Calvin Thrust said both he, Calvin Thrust, and the house manager had immediately on arrival pegged Lance as either coked up or dreamed to the gills on some dream. And Thrust said he summoned every orida of self-control sobriety blessed him with, and had quietly taken Lentz out of the office into the special disabled bedroom next door, and over the sound of Bert F. Smith coughing up little pieces of lung in his sleep, he said he'd really controlledly given Lentz the choice of voluntarily resigning his Ennett residency on the spot, or submitting to a spot urine and a room search and everything like that, plus to questioning by the finest, who were pretty doubtless, even now, en route, with a fleet of ambulances for the Nooks. Meanwhile, Thrust said, gesturing with the gasper and occasionally leaning forward to see whether Gately was still conscious and to tell him he looked like shit. Meanwhile, Gately had been lying there, passed out, wedged with 2 full filing cabinets to keep him from rolling off the couch he was whiter than, and was bleeding in a very big way, and nobody knew how to, like, affix a turnip cut to his shoulder. And the good-bodied new girl with the cloth mask was bending over the arm of the couch, applying pressure to towels on Gately's bleeding, and her partly open robe was yielding a view that even brought Alfonso P.C. around from his herniated fetal posture on the floor. And Thrust and the house manager were taking turns asking for help to intuitively know what they ought to do with Gately, because it was well known that he was on probie against a real serious bit, and with all due trust and respect to Don, it wasn't clear at that point, from the scattered, damaged Canadian forms still in different prone positions out in the street, who'd done what to who, in defense of whatever or not. And the finest tend to take a keen interest in huge guys who come into ERs with spectacular gunshot wounds. And but then when Pat M. pulled up in the Aventura, laying rubber a couple minutes later, she'd screamed rather unserenely at Thrust for not having already ricky-ticked Don Gately over to St. E's on his own already. Thrust said he'd let go of Pat screaming like water off a duck, revealing that Pat M. had been under felony-weight domestic stress at home, he knew. He said, and but so Gately was too heavy to carry unconscious for more than a few meters, even with the masked girl filling in for Perea Scarbo. And they just barely got Gately outside, still in his wet bowling shirt, and laid him briefly on the sidewalk and covered him with Pat's black suede car coat, while Thrust maneuvered his beloved Corvette up as close to Gately as possible. The sounds of sirens, on the way up Com Ave, mixed with the sounds of severely fucked-up Canadians returning to whatever passed with Nooks for consciousness, and calling for what they called mini-song, and with the crazed squirrel sound of Lentz trying to start his rusted-out brown duster, which had a bad solenoid. They'd heaved Gately's dead weight in the vet, and Pat M. drove interference like a madwoman in her turbocharged Aventura. Pat let the masked girl ride shotgun with her because the masked girl wouldn't quit asking her to let her come too. The house manager stayed behind to represent Ennett House to EMPHH Security and the somewhat less bullshittable BPD Finest. The sirens got steadily closer, which added to the confusion, because senile and mobile vegetable residents of both Unit Number 4 and the shed had been drawn out on the frozen lawns by the fracas, and the mix of several kinds of sirens didn't do them a bit of good, and they started flapping and shrieking and running around and adding to the medical confusion of the whole scene, which by the time him and Pat pulled out of there was a fucking mill house and everything like that. Thrust asks rhetorically, how much does Don fucking weigh, anyway? Because moving the front buckets way up to where, like, dwarves put them, and putting Gately's carcass across the back seat of the vet, had required all available hands, and even Bert F.S.'s stumps, had been like trying to get something humongous through a door that's way smaller than the humongous thing was, and everything like that. Thrust occasionally tapped his gasper, like he thought it was lit. The first squad cars had come fishtailing around the Warren Com corner just as they all came out of the EM driveway onto Warren. Pat, in her car up ahead, had made an arm motion that could have been either waving coolly at the passing finest or uncoolly clutching her head. Thrust said, had he mentioned Gately's blood? Gately'd bled all over Pat M's vinyl couch and filing cabinets and carpet. The little EM streetlet, the sidewalk, Pat M's black suede car coat, pretty much everybody's winter coats, and the beloved upholstery of Thrust's beloved Corvette, which upholstery, Thrust might add, had been new and dear. But he said not to worry about it, Thrust said. The fucking blood was the least of the problems. Gately didn't like the sound of that at all, and started trying to blink at him in a kind of crude code to get his attention, but Thrust either didn't notice it or thought it was like a post-operative tic. Thrust's hair was always combed straight back like a mobster. Thrust said at the St. E's ER how the ER crew had been quick and ingenious about getting Gately out of the vet and onto a double-width gurney, though they did have some trouble lifting the gurney so they could get the legs with wheels set up under it so the guys in white could roll him in with more guys in white talking briskly alongside of him and leaning over him and applying pressure and barking little orders in terse code like they always do in ERs and everything like that. In emergencies. Thrust says he couldn't tell if they could tell right away it was a spectacular gunshot wound. Nobody used the G-word or anything like that. Thrust had babbled something about a chainsaw while Pat nodded furiously. The chief two things Gately kept blinking rhythmically to try to find out were, did anybody end up getting killed, meaning the Nooks, and has this one certain ADA-type figure that always wore a hat come in from Essex County or given any sign of getting wind of Gately's whereabouts or involvement. And, so really, three things. And, will any of the Ennett House residents that were right there on the scene from start to finish look respectable enough on paper to have creditability as, like, witnesses? Plus, he wouldn't mind knowing what the fuck Thrust was thinking of, scaring Lentz off and letting him screw off into the urban night, leaving Gately maybe holding the statutory bag. Most of Calvin Thrust's legality experience was filmic and petty vice. Thrust eventually describes that One of the house manager's key coups of quick thinking was doing a quick TP scan and finding out which of the residents out there milling around with the catatonics on the street had up-in-the-air legal issues, such that they needed to be sea-cloistered in the protected area of the house, out of legal sight by the time the BPD's finest hit the scene. He says in his view it was lucky for Gately that he, Gately, was such a massive son of a bitch and had so much blood because, even so, Gately'd lost huge volumes of blood all over people's upholstery and was in shock and everything like that by the time they got him on the double with Gurney, his face cheese-colored and his lips blue and muttering all this shock-type stuff. But even so, here he, Gately, was. Not exactly ready for a GQ cover, but still sucking air. Truss said in the waiting room at the ER, where they wouldn't let a working man smoke down there either. He said then the arrogant new girl resident in the white veil had up and tried to take Thrust's inventory for letting Randy L. resign and decamp before his parting Gately's legal embryoglio could be nailed down. And Pat M. had been pretty unconditionally loving about it, but it was obvious she wasn't thrilled with Thrust's tactics either, and everything like that. Gately blinked furiously to signify his agreement with Joelle's position. Calvin Thrust gestured stoically with his cigarette and said he'd told Pat M. the truth. He always told the truth, no matter how unpleasant for himself today. He said he'd encouraged Lenz to ricky-tick out of there because otherwise he was afraid that he, Thrust, was going to eliminate Lenz's map on the spot, out of rage. Lenz's solenoid appeared to have been on the permanent dickey, because the rusty duster was seen by new resident Amy J. real early the next a.m., getting towed from its wrong side of the street spot in front of number 3, when Amy J. slunk back to the house all jonesy and hungover to get her hefty bag full of evicted personal shit. Lenz, apparently having abandoned his wheels and fleeing off by foot during all the finest's confusion and static with the ambulance drivers that, who could blame them, didn't want to take Canadians because of horrible paperwork for health card reimbursement for Nux. The house manager had gone so far as planting herself out in front of the house's locked front door with her not-all-that-small arms and legs spread out, blocking the door, assertively stating at whatever finest tried to enter that Ennett House was court-mandated protected by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and could only be entered with a court order and 3 working days mandated time for the house to file an injunction and wait for a ruling. And the finest and even the booger-eating morons from EMPHH Security were successfully held in bay and kept out, therefore, by her, alone. And Pat M. was considering rewarding the house manager's coolness under fire by promoting her to assistant director next month, when the present assistant director left to go get certified in jet engine maintenance at East Coast Aerotech on a mass rehab grant. Gately's eyes kept rolling up in his head, only partly from pain. Unless he actually had a lit gasper going, Calvin Thrust always has this way of being only technically wherever he was. There was always this air of imminent departure about him, like a man whose beeper was about to sound. It's like a lit gasper was psychic ballast for him or something. Everything he said to Gately seemed like it was going to be the last thing he said, right before he looked at his watch and slapped his forehead and left. Thrust said, whatever that nuck that the residents allege shot him with, was serious ordnance, because there'd been bits of Gately's shoulder and bowling shirt all over the complex's little street. Thrust pointed at the huge bandage and asked whether they'd talked to Gately yet about was he going to get to keep what was left of the mutilated shoulder and arm. Gately found that the only audible sound he could make sounded like a run-over kitten. Thrust mentioned that Daniel S. had been over to mass rehab with Bert F.S., and then reported how they were doing miraculous things with prostheses these days. Gately's eyes were rolling around in his head, and he was making pathetic little scared, aspirated sounds as he pictured himself with a hook and parrot and patch, making piratical, arr, matey, sounds from the AA podium. He felt a terrible certainty that the whole nerve assembly network that connected the human voice box to the human mind and let somebody ask for crucial legal and medical feedback must run through the right human shoulder. All kinds of fucking shunts and crazy interconnections with nerves, he knew. He imagined himself with one of those solar cell electric shaver voice box prostheses he has to hold up to his throat, maybe with his hook, trying to carry the message with it from the podium, sounding like an automatic teller or ROM audio interface. Gailey wanted to know what day the next day was, and whether any of Lentz's nooks had been demapped, and what the official capacity of the guy was in the hat, who'd been sitting just outside the door to the room either last night or the night before, his hat's shadow cast in a kind of parallelogram across the open doorway. And if the guy was still there, assuming the sight of the guy's hatted shadow had been valid and not phantasmic. Andy wondered how they went about cuffing you if one of your arm's shoulders was mutilated and the size of your head. If Gailey took anything deeper than a half-breath, a mind-bending sheet of pain goes down his right side. He even breathed like a sick kitten, more like throbbing than breathing. Thrust said Hester Thrail had apparently disappeared sometime during the fracas and never came back. Gailey could remember her running, screaming off into the urban night. Thrust said her Alfa Romeo got towed the next AM, right along with Lentz's bum duster, and her stuff's been duly bagged and is on the porch, and everything familiar like that. Thrust said they found this mysteriously huge stash of high-quality Irish luggage during the staff's search of Lentz's room, and the house looks to be fixed for trash and eviction bags for the next fiscal year. Discharged residents' bagged possessions stay on the porch for 3 days. And Gately's trying to calculate the present date from this fact. Thrust says Emil Minty got a full house restriction for getting observed removing one of Hester Thrail's undergarments from her bag on the porch, for reasons nobody much wants to speculate about. Kate Gompert and Ruth Van Cleve supposedly went to hit an NA meeting in Inman Square and got supposedly mugged and separated, and then only Ruth Van Cleve showed up back at the house. And Pat's worn out a PC warrant for Gompert because of the girl's other psych and suicide issues. Gately discovers he doesn't even all that much care whether anybody thought to call Stavros L. at the Shattuck about Gately's day job. Thrust smoothed his hair back and said, "What else? Let's see." Jeanette Fultz is so far covering Gately's shifts and said to say he's in her prayers. Chandler Foss finished out his 9 months and graduated, but came back the next morning and hung around for morning meditation, which has to be a good sign, sobriety-wise, for the old chandulator. Jennifer Belbin did get indicted on the bad check issue up in Wellfleet Circuit Court, but they're going to let her finish out her residency at the house before anything goes to trial, which her PD said graduating the house is guaranteed to get her bit cut in at least half. The assistant director had gone up to court with Belbin on her own time. Dooney Glynn still laid up with a diveritis thing, and can be neither coaxed nor threatened out of his fetal position in bed. And the house manager's trying to breastwork through the red tape at health to get them to okay him admission to St. E's, even though he's got insurance fraud on his yellow sheet, part of his own past wreckage. A guy that had gone through the house back when Thrust did, and had stayed sober in AA for 4 solid years, had suddenly, out of nowhere, slipped up and took the first drink, the same day as the Lentz fracas, and predictably ended getting totally shit-faced, and went and fell off the end of the Fort Point Pier. Like, literally, took a long walk on a short pier, apparently, and sank like a rock. And the memorial service is today, which is why Thrust is going to have to take off in a second here, he says. The nude kid Tingley's coming out of the linen closet for up to an hour at a time, and is taking solid food. And Jeanette's quit lobbying to have the kid sent over to Met State. The even newer new guy now that's come in to take Chandler Foss's spot's name is Dave Kay, and is one grim story to behold, Thrust assures him. A junior executive guy at ATH SCME Air Displacement. An upscale guy with a picket house and kids and a worried wife with tall hair. Who this David Kay's bottom was, he drank half a liter of Cuerva at some ATH SCME Interdependence Day office party and everything like that, and got in some insane drunken limbo dance challenge with a rival executive and tried to, like, limbo under a desk or a chair or something insanely low, and got his spine all fucked up in a limbo lock, maybe permanently. So the newest new guy scuttles around the in-house living room like a crab, his scalp brushing the floor and his knees trembling with effort. Danielle S. thinks Bert F.S. might have Batorial pneumonia or some kind of chronic lung thing. and Jeff D's trying to get the other residents to sign a petition to get Bert barred from the kitchen and dining room because Bert can't cover his mouth when he coughs, understandably. Thrust says Clinette H. and Yolanda W. are taking meals in their room and are under orders not to come down or go near any windows because of what happened to the map of the nook they allegedly stomped and everything like that. Gately mews and blinks like mad. Thrust says everybody's being real supportive of Jenny B. and encouraging her to turn the Wellfleet indictment over to her higher power. The shed staff are still rolling the catatonic lady's wheelchair over from the shed to the house on scheduled AMs. And Thrust says Jeanette had to write up Minty and Dial for putting one of those gag arrows that are curved in the middle and look like there's an arrow through your head over the catatonic lady's paralyzed head yesterday and leaving her slumped by the TP like that all day. Plus Thrail's panties. So suddenly, in 12 hours, Minty's just one more offense away from getting the shoe, which Thrust is already personally shining the tip of his very sharpest shoe in hopes. The biggest issue at the House bitch and complaint meeting was that earlier this week, it turns out Clinette H. had brung in this whole humongous shitload of cartridges she said they were getting ready to throw in the dumpster up at the swank tennis school up the hill she works at. And she promoted them and hauled them down to the house, and the residents all have a wild hair because Pat says staff has to preview the cartridges for suitability and sex before they can be put out for the residents. And the residents are all bitching that this will take forever. And it's just the fucking staff hoarding the new entertainment when the house's TP's just about on its hands and knees in the entertainment desert, starving for new entertainment. McDade bitched at the meeting that if he had to watch Nightmare on Elm Street 22, The Senescence, one more time, he was going to take a Brody off the house's roof. Plus, Thrust says, Bruce Green hasn't shared word one to staff about his feelings about anything to do with Lentz or Gately's embryoglio, that he just sits around waiting for somebody to read his mind, that his roommates have complained that he thrashes and shouts about nuts and cigars in his sleep. Calvin Thrust, 4 years sober, straddling the backwards chair, keeps inclining himself ever more forward in the posture of a man who's at any moment going to push up, off, out of the chair, and leave. He reports how something deep in the previously, hopelessly arrogant-seeming tiny Yule seems like it's broken and melted, spiritually speaking. The guy shaved off his Kentucky chicken beard, was heard weeping in the five-man head, and was observed by Jeanette taking out the kitchen trash in secret, even though his chore this week was office windows. Thrust had discovered fine dining in sobriety, and has the beginning of chins. His hair is slicked back with odorless stuff at all times, and he has a more or less permanent sore on his upper lip. Gately, for some reason, keeps imagining Joelle Van Dyne dressed as Madame Psychosis, sitting in a plain chair in the three-woman room eating a peach and looking out the open window at the crucifix atop St. Elizabeth's Hospital's prolix roof. The crucifix isn't big, but it's up so high it's visible from most anywhere in Enfield, Brighton. Sees Joelle delicately pulling the veil out to get the peach up under it. Thrust says Charlotte Treat's T-cell count is down. She's needle-pointing Gately some kind of get-better-a-day-at-a-time, assuming that's God's will, doily. But it's been slow going, because Treat's developed some kind of goopy virus-related eye infection that's got her bumping into walls. And her counselor, Maureen N., at the staff meeting, wanted Pat to consider having her transferred to an HIV halfway house up in Everett that's got some recovering addicts in there. Morris Hanley, speaking of T-cells, has baked some cream cheese brownies for Gately as a nurturing gesture. But then the twats at the Trauma Wings nurse's station like impounded them from Thrust when he came up. But he'd had a couple on the way over in the bloodstained vet, and he could assure Don that Hanley's brownies were worth killing a loved one for and everything like that. Gately feels a sudden rush of anxiety over the issue of who's cooking the house supper in his absence. Like, will they know to put cornflakes in the meatloaf for texture? He finds Thrust insufferable and wishes he'd just fucking go already, but has to admit he's less conscious of the horrific pain when somebody's there. But that's mostly because the drowned panic of not being able to ask questions or have any input into what somebody's saying is so awful, it sort of dwarfs the pain. Thrust puts his unlit gasper behind his ear, where Gately predicts hair tonic will render it unsmokable. Looks conspiratorially around back over each shoulder. Leans in so his face is visible between two bars of the bed's side railing, and bathes Gately's face in old eggs and smoke as he leans in and quietly says that Gately will be psyched to hear that all the residents that were at the Imbrioglio, except Lentz and Thrail and the ones that aren't in a legal position to step forward and like that, he says, they've most of them all come forward and filed depositions, that the BPD's finest, plus some rather weirder federal guys with goofy-looking, archaic crew cuts, probably involved because of the, like, inter-ONAN element of the Nooks. Here, Gately's big heart skips and sinks. Have come around and been voluntarily admitted inside. On Pat's written okay. And they took depositions, which is like testifying on paper. And the depositions look to be basically 110% behind Don Gately and support a justifiable seniorio of either self-defense or Lentz defense. Several testimonies indicate the Nooks gave the impression of being under the influence of aggressive-type substances. The single biggest problem right now, Thrust says, Pat says, is the missing alleged item. As in the 44-item Gately was plugged with's whereabouts are missing, Thrust says. The last resident to depose to seeing it was Green, who says he took it away from the Nook the nigger girl stomped, whereupon he, Green, says he dropped it on the lawn. Whereupon it, like, vanished from legal view. Thrust says that in his legal view, the item's the thing that makes the difference between a seniorio of iron-shod self-defense and one of just maybe a huge fucking beef in which Gately got mysteriously plugged at some indefinite point while rearranging a couple Canadian maps with his huge, bare hands. Gately's heart is now somewhere around his bare, hairy shins, at the mention of federal crew cuts. His attempted plea for Thrust to come out and say, did he actually kill anybody, did he? Sounds like that crushed kitten again. The pain of the terror is past standing, and it helps him surrender and quit trying. And he relaxes his legs and decides Thrust gets to not say whatever he wants. But the reality right this second is that he's mute and powerless over Thrust. Thrust leans in and hugs the back of the chair and says, Lynette Henderson and Yolanda Willis are on full house restriction in their room to keep them from coming down and maybe fucking themselves over legally in a deposition. Because the Nook with the plaid hat with the ear flaps and the missing alleged item had expired on the spot from a spike heel through the right eye as he was getting the shit stomped out of him as only female niggers can stop and everything like that. And Yolanda Willis had very shrewdly left the shoe and spike heel right there, protruding from the guy's map with her toe prints all over its insides, meaning presumably the shoes. So producing the item was going to be in her strong legal interests too, as well, as Thrust analyzes the legal landscape. Thrust says Pat's limped around and appealed to every single resident personally, and everybody submitted more or less voluntarily to a room and property search and everything like that, and still no large-caliber item has turned up, though Nell Gunther's hidden Oriental knife collection sure made an impression. Thrust predicts it'll be strongly in Gately's lego-judicial interest and everything like that to ransack his brain and mind for where and with who he last saw the alleged gun. The sun was starting to go down over the West Newton Hills, through the double-sealed windows now, trembling slightly, and the window light against the far wall was ruddled and bloody. The heater vents kept making a sound like a distant parent gently shushing. When it starts to get dark out is when the ceiling breathes. And everything like that. Sometime later at night, backlit by the light of the hall, is the figure of resident Jeffrey Day, sitting where Thrust had sat, but with a chair turned around the right way, and with his legs primly crossed, eating a cream cheese brownie he reports they're passing out free to people down at the nurse's station. Day says Jeanette F. is certainly no Don Gately in the culinary arena. She seems to enjoy some sort of collusive, kickback-type relationship with the manufacturers of Spam, Day says, is his theory. It might be a whole different night. The nighttime ceiling no longer bulges convexly with Gately's own shallow breaths, and the improved sounds he can now make have evolved from feline to more like bovine. But his right side hurts so bad he can barely hear. It's gone from a fiery pain to cold, dead, deep, tight pain, with a queer flavor of emotional loss to it. From deep inside he can hear the pain laughing at the 90 milligrams of Toradol IM they've got in the IV drip. As with Ewell, when Gately comes up out of sleep, there's no way to tell how long Day's been there, or quite why. Day is plowing through a long story, it seems, about his relationship growing up with his younger brother. Gately has a hard time imagining Day being blood-related to anybody. Day says his brother was developmentally challenged in some way. He had enormous red, wet, loose lips, and wore eyeglasses so thick his eyes had looked like an ant's eyes growing up. Part of his challenge was that Day's brother had had a crippling phobic fear of leaves, apparently. As in ordinary leaves. From trees. Day's been sucker-punched by an emergent sober memory of how he used to emotionally abuse his little brother simply by threatening to touch him with a leaf. Day has this way of holding his cheek and jaw when he talks, like cut-out photos of the late Jack Benny. It's not at all evident why Day's choosing to share this stuff with a mute and feverishly semi-conscious Gately. It seems like Don G's gotten way more popular as somebody to talk to since he's become effectively paralyzed and mute. The ceiling's behaving itself, but in the room's gray, Gately could still make out a tally, insubstantial, ghostish figure appearing and disappearing in the mist of his vision's periphery. There was some creepy relationship between the figure's postures and the passing nurse's noiseless glide. This figure pretty definitely seemed to prefer night to Day, though by this point Gately could well have been asleep again, as Day began to describe different species of handheld leaves. A recurring bad dream Gately's had ever since he gave up and came in and got straight consists simply of a tiny acne-scarred Oriental woman looking down at him. Nothing else happens. She's just looking down at Gately. Her acne scars aren't even all that bad. The thing is that she's tiny. She's one of those tiny, little, anonymous Oriental women you see all over Metro Boston, always seeming to be carrying multiple shopping bags. But in the recurring dream, she's looking down at him. From his perspective, he's looking up and she's looking down. Which means Gately in the dream is either A, lying down on his back looking vulnerably up at her, or B, is himself even more incredibly tiny than the woman. Involved in the dream also, in a menacing way somehow, is a dog standing rigidly in the distance past the Oriental woman, motionless and rigid in profile, standing there still and straight as a toy. The Oriental woman has no particular expression and never says anything, though her face's scars have a certain elusive pattern to them that seems like it wants to mean something. When Gately opens his eyes again, Jeffrey Day's gone, and his hospital bed, with its railings and IV bottles on stands, has been moved way over so that it's right up next to the bed of whoever the person in the room's other bed is, so it's like Gately and this unknown patient are a sexless old couple sleeping together but in separate beds, and Gately's mouth goes oval, and his eyes bug out with horror, and his effort at yelling hurts enough to wake him up, and his eyelids shoot up and rattle like old window shades, and his hospital bed's back where it's always been, and a nurse is giving the anonymous guy in the other bed some sort of late-night-type shot you could tell was narcotic. And the patient, who has a very deep voice, is crying. Then somewhere later, in the couple of hours before midnight's parking switch symphony on Washington Street outside, is an unpleasantly detailed dream where the ghostish figure that's been flickering in and out of sight around the room finally stays in one spot long enough for Gately to really check him out. In the dream, it's the figure of a very tall, sunken-chested man, in black framed glasses and a sweatshirt, with old stained chinos, leaning back sort of casually, or else morosely slumped, resting its tailbone against the windowsill's ventilator's whispering grill, with its long arms hanging at its sides and its ankles casually crossed so that Gately can even see the detail that the ghostly chinos aren't long enough for its height. They're the kind kids used to call high waters in Gately's childhood. A couple of Bimmy Gately's savager pals would corner some pencil-necked kid in those type too-short trousers on the playground and go like, "Yo, little brother, where's the fucking flood?" And then lay the kid out with a head slap or chest shove so the inevitable violin went skittering ass over tea kettle across the blacktop in its case. The creepy ghostish figure's arm sometimes like vanishes and then reappears at the bridge of its nose, pushing the glasses up in a weary, unconscious, morose gesture, just like those kids in the high-water pants on the playground always did, in a weak, morose way that always somehow made Gately himself want to shove them savagely in the chest. Gately, in the dream, experienced a painful adrenal flash of remorse and entertained the possibility that the figure represented one of the North Shore violin-playing kids he'd never kept his savage pals from abusing, now come in an adult state when Gately was vulnerable and mute to exact some kind of payback. The ghostly figure shrugged its thin shoulders and said, "But no, it was nothing of the sort. It was just a plain old wraith, one without any sort of grudge or agenda. Just a generic, garden-variety wraith." Gately, sarcastically in the dream, thought that, "Oh, well, then, if it was just a garden-variety wraith is all, geez, what a fucking relief." The wraith figure smiled apologetically and shrugged, shifting its tailbone on the whispering grill a bit. There was an odd quality to its movements in the dream. They were of regulation speed, the movements, but they seemed oddly segmented and deliberate, as if more effort than necessary were going into them somehow. Then Gately considered that who knew what was necessary or normal for a self-proclaimed generic wraith in a pain and fever dream. Then he considered that this was the only dream he could recall where even in the dream he knew that it was a dream, much less lay there considering the fact that he was considering the upfront dream quality of the dream he was dreaming. It quickly got so multi-leveled and confusing that his eyes rolled back in his head. The wraith made a weary, morose gesture, as if not wanting to bother to get into any sort of confusing dream versus real controversies. The wraith said Gately might as well stop trying to figure it out and just capitalize on its presence, the wraith's presence, in the room or dream, whatever, because Gately, if he'd bothered to notice and appreciate it, at least didn't have to speak out loud to be able to interface with the wraith figure. And also, the wraith figure said, it was, by the way, requiring incredible patience and fortitude for him, the wraith, to stay in one position long enough for Gately to really see him and interface with him. And the wraith was making no promises about how many more months he, the wraith, could keep it up, since fortitude had never seemed to have been his long suit. The city's aggregate nighttime lights lightened the sky through the room's window to the same dark rose shade you see when you close your eyes, adding to the dream of dream-type ambiguity. Gately, in the dream, tried the test of pretending to lose consciousness so the wraith would go away, and then somewhere during the pretense lost consciousness and really did sleep, for a bit, in the dream, because the tiny-pocked oriental woman was back and looking wordlessly down at him, plus the creepy rigid dog. And then the sedated patient in the next bed woke Gately back up, in the original dream, with some kind of narcotized gurgle or snore, and the so-called wraith figure was still there and visible, only now it was standing on top of the railing at the side of Gately's bed, looking down at him now, from a towering railing plus original tallness height, having to exaggerate his shoulder's natural slump in order to clear the ceiling. Gately got a clear view of an impressive thatch of nostril hair, looking up into the wraith's nostrils, and also a clear lateral look at the wraith's skinny ankles like ankle bones, bulging in brown socks below the cuffs of the high-water chinos. As much as his shoulder, calf, toe, and whole right side were hurting, it occurred to Gately that you don't normally think of wraiths or ghostish phantasms as being tall or short, or having bad posture, or wearing certain colored socks, much less having anything as specific as extrusive nostril hair. There was a degree of, what, specificness about this figure in this dream that Gately found troubling. Much less having the unpleasant old Oriental woman dream inside this dream right here, he began to wish again that he could call out for assistance or to wake himself up. But now, not even Moose or Muse would come. All he could seem to do was pant real hard, as if the air was like totally missing his vocal box, or like his vocal box was totally demapped from nerve damage in his shoulder, and now just sort of hung there, all withered and dry, like an old hornet nest, while air rushed out Gately's throat all around it. His throat still didn't feel right. It was exactly the suffocated speechlessness in dreams, nightmares, Gately realized. This was both terrifying and reassuring somehow. Evidence for the dream element and so on, and so forth. The Wraith was looking down at him and nodding sympathetically. The Wraith could empathize totally, it said. The Wraith said, even a garden variety Wraith could move at the speed of quanta, and be anywhere, anytime, and hear in symphonic toto the thoughts of animate men. But it couldn't ordinarily affect anybody or anything solid, and it could never speak right to anybody. A Wraith had no out loud voice of its own, and had to use somebody's, like, internal brain voice if it wanted to try to communicate something, which was why thoughts and insights that were coming from some Wraith always just sound like your own thoughts, from inside your own head, if a Wraith's trying to interface with you. The Wraith says, by way of illustration, consider phenomena like intuition, or inspiration, or hunches, or when someone, for instance, says, a little voice inside was telling them such and such, on an intuitive basis. Gately can now take no more than a third of a normal breath without wanting to throw up from the pain. The Wraith was pushing his glasses up and saying, besides, it took incredible discipline and fortitude and patient effort to stay stock still in one place for long enough for an animate man actually to see and be in any way affected by a Wraith. And very few Wraiths had anything important enough to interface about to be willing to stand still for this kind of time, preferring ordinarily to whiz around at the invisible speed of quanta. The Wraith says, it doesn't really matter whether Gately knows what the term quanta means. He says, Wraiths, by and large, exist, putting his arms out slowly and making little quotation mark finger wiggles as he said exist, in a totally different Heisenbergian dimension of rate change and time passage. As an example, he goes on, normal animate men's actions and motions look, to a Wraith, to be occurring at about the rate a clock's hour hand moves, and are just about as interesting to look at. Gately was thinking, for fuck's sake, what was this? Now even in unpleasant fever dreams, now somebody else is going to tell him their troubles, now that Gately can't get away or dialogue back with anything about his own experience? He normally couldn't ever get Ewell or Day to sit down for any kind of real or honest mutual sharing, and now that he's totally mute and inert and passive all of a sudden, everybody seems to view him as a sympathetic ear, or not even a sympathetic real ear, more like a wooden carving or statue of an ear. An empty confessional booth. Don G. as huge, empty confessional booth. The Wraith disappears, and instantly reappears in a far corner of the room, waving hi at him. It was slightly reminiscent of Bewitched reruns from Gately's toddlerhood. The Wraith disappears, again, and again just as instantly reappears, now holding one of Gately's Ennett House basement flea-baggy staff bedrooms cut out and scotch-taped celebrity photos. This one an old one of U.S. Head of State Johnny Gentle, famous crooner, on stage wearing velour, twirling a mic, from back in the days before he went to a copper-colored toupee, when he used a strigil instead of a UV flash booth, and was just a Vegas crooner. Again, the Wraith disappears, and instantly reappears holding a can of Coke, with good old Coke's distinctive interwoven red and white French curls on it, but alien, unfamiliar, Oriental-type writing on it instead of the good old words Coca-Cola and Coke. The unfamiliar script on the Coke can is maybe the whole dream's worst moment. The Wraith walks jerkily and over-deliberately across the floor, and then up a wall, occasionally disappearing and then reappearing, sort of fluttering mistily, and ends up standing upside down on the hospital room's drop ceiling, directly over Gately, and holds one knee to its sunken chest, and starts doing what Gately would know were pirouettes if he'd ever once been exposed to ballet, pirouetting faster and faster, and then so fast, the Wraith's nothing but a long stalk of sweatshirt and Coke can-colored light that seems to extrude from the ceiling. And then, in a moment, that rivals the Coke can moment for unpleasantness into Gately's personal mind, in Gately's own brain voice, but with roaring and unwilling force, comes the term, pirouette, in caps, which term Gately knows for a fact. He doesn't have any idea what it means, and no reason to be thinking it with roaring force. So the sensation is not only creepy but somehow violating, a sort of lexical rape. Gately begins to consider this hopefully non-recurring dream even more unpleasant than the tiny pocked Oriental woman dream, overall. Other terms and words Gately knows he doesn't know from a divot in the sod now come crashing through his head with the same ghastly intrusive force. For example, a chakature, and alembic, latrodectus mactans, and neutral density point, chiaroscuro, and proprioception, and testudo, and annulate, and bricolage, and catalept, and gerrymander, and scopophilia, and Laertes. And all of a sudden it occurs to Gately the aforethought extruding, strigil, and lexical themselves, and lordosis, and impost, and sinistral, and meniscus, and chronexy, and poor Yorick, and lucullus, and cerise Montclair, and then desicca neo real crane dolly, and circumambient found drama leverate marriage. And then more lexical terms and words speeding up to chipmunkish, and then heliated, and then all the way up to a sound like a mosquito on speed, and Gately tries to clutch both his temples with one hand and scream, but nothing comes out. When the Wraith reappears, it's seated way up behind him, where Gately has to let his eyes roll way back in his head to see him. And it turns out Gately's heart is being medically monitored, and the Wraith is seated up on the heart monitor in a strange cross-legged posture, with his pant cuffs pulled up so high Gately could see the actual skinny, hairless, above-the-sock skin of the Wraith's ankles glowing a bit in the spilled light of the trauma wing hall. The Oriental can of Coke now rests on Gately's broad, flat forehead. It's cold and smells a little funny. Like low tide, the can. Now, footsteps and the sound of bubblegum in the hall. An orderly shines a flashlight in and plays it over Gately and the narcotized roommate and environs, and makes marks on a clipboard while blowing a small orange bubble. It's not like the light passes through the Wraith or anything dramatic. The Wraith simply disappears the instant the light hits the heart monitor and reappears the instant it moves away. Gately's unpleasant dreams definitely don't normally include specific gum color and intense physical discomfort and invasions of lexical terms he doesn't know from Shinola. Gately begins to conclude it's not impossible that the garden variety Wraith and the heart monitor, though not conventionally real, could be a sort of epiphany-ish visitation from Gately's personally confused understanding of God, a higher power or something. Maybe sort of like the legendary pulsing blue light that AA founder Bill W. historically saw during his last detox that turned out to be God telling him how to stay sober via starting AA and carrying the message. The Wraith smiles sadly and says something like, "Don't we both wish, young sir?" Kaylee's forehead wrinkling as his eyes keep rolling up makes the foreign can wobble coldly. Of course, there's also the possibility that the tall, slumped, extremely fast wraith might represent the sergeant-at-arms, the disease, exploiting the loose security of Gately's fever-addled mind, getting ready to fuck with his motives and persuade him to accept Demerol just once. Just one last time. For the totally legitimate medical pain. Gately lets himself wonder what it would be like, able to quantum off any place instantly and stand on ceilings and probably burgle like no burglar'd ever dreamed of, but not able to really affect anything or interface with anybody, having nobody know you're there, having people's normal, rushed daily lives look like the movements of planets and suns, having to sit patiently very still in one place for a long time, even to have some poor, addled son of a bitch even be willing to entertain your maybe being there. It'd be real free-seeming, but incredibly lonely, he imagines. Gately knows a thing or two about loneliness, he feels. Does wraith mean like a ghost, as in dead? Is this a message from a higher power about sobriety and death? What would it be like to try and talk, and have the person think it was just their own mind talking? Gately could maybe identify to an extent, he decides. This is the only time he's ever been struck dumb, except for a brief but nasty bout of pleuritic laryngitis he'd had when he was 24 and sleeping on the cold beach up in Gloucester, and he doesn't like it a bit, the being struck dumb. It's like some combination of invisibility and being buried alive, in terms of the feeling. It's like being strangled somewhere deeper inside you than your neck. Gately imagines himself with a piratical hook, unable to speak on commitments because he can only gurgle and pant, doomed to an AA life of ashtrays and urns. The wraith reaches down and removes the can of un-American tonic from Gately's forehead, and assures Gately he can more than identify with an animate man's feelings of communicative impotence and mute strangulation. Gately's thoughts become agitated as he tries to yell, mentally, that he never said a fucking thing about impotence. He's got a way clearer and more direct view of the wraith's extreme nostril hair situation than he preferred to. The wraith hefts the can absently and says, age 28 seems old enough for Gately to remember U.S. broadcast television's old network situation comedies of the BS 80s and 90s, probably. Gately has to smile at the wraith's cluelessness. Gately's, after all, a fucking drug addict, and a drug addict's second most meaningful relationship is always with his domestic entertainment unit, TV/VCR or HDTP. A drug addict's maybe the only human species whose own personal vision has a vertical hold, for Christ's sake, he thinks. And Gately, even in recovery, can still summon great verbatim chunks, not only of drug-addicted adolescences, Seinfeld and Ren and Stimpy and Who Is He When He's at Home and Exposed Northerners, but also the syndicated Bewitched and Hazel and ubiquitous MASH. He grew to monstrous childhood size in front of, and especially the hometown, ensemble-casted Cheers, both the late network version with the stacked brunette and the syndicated older ones with the titless blonde, which Gately, even after the switch over to Interlace and HDTP dissemination, felt like he had a special personal relationship with Cheers, not only because everybody on the show always had a cold foamer in hand, just like in real life, but because Gately's big childhood claim to recognition had been his eerie resemblance to the huge, neckless, simian-browed accountant, Nom, who more or less seemed to live at the bar and was unkind but not cruel and drank foamer after foamer without once hitting anybody's mom or pitching over sideways and passing out in vomit somebody else had to clean up and who looked right down to the massive square head and Neanderthal brow and paddle-sized thumbs eerily like the child D.W. Bim Gately, hulking and neckless and shy, riding his broom handle, cirrhosis of the liver. and the wraith on the heart monitor looks pensively down at Gately from upside down and asks, does Gately remember the myriad thespian extras on, for example, his beloved Cheers? Not the center stage, Sam and Carla and Noam, but the nameless patrons always at tables, filling out the bar's crowd, concessions to realism, always relegated to back and foreground, and always having utterly silent conversations. Their faces would animate and mouths move realistically, but without sound. Only the named stars at the bar itself could audibilize. The Wraith says these fractional actors, human scenery, could be seen but not heard in most pieces of filmed entertainment. And Gately remembers them, the extras in all public scenes, especially like bar and restaurant scenes, or rather, remembers how he doesn't quite remember them, how it never struck his addled mind as, in fact, surreal, that their mouths moved but nothing emerged. And what a miserable fucking bottom-rung job that must be for an actor to be sort of human furniture. Figurants, the Wraith says they're called, these surreally mute background presences whose presence really revealed that the camera, like any eye, has a perceptual corner, a triage of who's important enough to be seen and heard versus just seen. A term from ballet, originally, figurant, the Wraith explains. The Wraith pushes his glasses up in the vaguely sniveling way of a kid that's just got slapped around on the playground, and says he personally spent the vast bulk of his own former animate life as pretty much a figurant. Furniture at the periphery of the very eyes closest to him, it turned out, and that it's one heck of a crummy way to try to live. Gately, whose increasing self-pity leaves little room or patience for anybody else's self-pity, tries to lift his left hand and wiggle his pinky to indicate the world's smallest viola playing the theme from The Sorrow and the Pity. But even moving his left arm makes him almost faint. And either the Wraith is saying or Gately is realizing that you can't appreciate the dramatic pathos of a figurant until you realize how completely trapped and encaged he is in his mute peripheral status. Because, like, say for example, if one of Cheers's bar's figurants suddenly decided he couldn't take it anymore, and stood up and started shouting and gesturing around wildly in a bid for attention and non-peripheral status on the show, Gately realizes, all that would happen is that one of the audibilizing named stars of the show would bolt over from stage center and apply restraints or the Heineken maneuver or CPR, figuring the silent gesturing figurant was choking on a beer nut or something, and that then the whole rest of that episode of Cheers would be about jokes about the named star's life-saving heroics, or else his fuck-up in applying the Heineken maneuver to somebody who wasn't choking on a nut. No way for a figurant to win. No possible voice or focus for the encaged figurant. Gately speculates briefly about the suicide statistics for bottom-rung actors. The Wraith disappears and then reappears in the chair by the bed's railing, leaning forward with its chin on its hands on the railing, in what Gately is coming to regard as the classic, tell your troubles to the trauma patient that can't interrupt or get away position. The Wraith says that he himself, the Wraith, when animate, had dabbled in filmed entertainments, as in making them. Cartridges, for Gately's info, to either believe or not. But in the entertainments the Wraith himself made, he says he goddamn bloody well made sure that either the whole entertainment was silent, or else if it wasn't silent, that you could bloody well hear every single performer's voice, no matter how far out on the cinematographic or narrative periphery they were, and that it wasn't just the self-conscious overlapping dialogue of a poseur like Schwulst or Altman, that is, it wasn't just the crafted imitation of oral chaos. It was real life's real egalitarian babble of figurantless crowds, of the animate world's real agora, the babble of crowds every member of which was the central
342
and articulate protagonist of his own entertainment. It occurs to Gately he's never had any sort of dream where somebody says anything like vast bulk, much less agora, which Gately interprets as a kind of expensive sweater. Which is why, the Wraith is continuing, the complete unfigurated egalitarian oral realism is why party-line entertainment critics always complained that the Wraith's entertainment's public area scenes were always incredibly dull and self-conscious and irritating. That they could never hear the really meaningful central narrative conversations for all the unfiltered babble of the peripheral crowd, which they assumed the babble-slash-babel was some self-conscious viewer-hostile heavy art directorial pose instead of radical realism. The Wraith's grim smile almost disappears before it appears. Gately's slight, tight smile back is the way you can always tell he's not really listening. He's remembering that he used to pretend to himself that the unviolent and sarcastic accountant Nom on Cheers was Gately's own organic father, straining to hold young Bimmy on his lap and letting him draw finger pictures in the condensation rings on the bar top, and when he was pissed off at Gately's mother, being sarcastic and witty, instead of getting her down and administering horribly careful U.S. Navy brig-type beatings that hurt like hell but would never bruise or show. The can of foreign coke has left a ring on his forehead that's colder than the feverish skin around it, and Gately tries to concentrate on the cold of the ring, instead of the dead, cold, total ache on his whole right side. Dextral, or the sober memory of his mother, Mrs. Gately's ex-significant other, the little-eyed former MP in khaki skivvies, hunched, drunk over his notebook's record of his Heinekens for the day, his tongue in the corner of his mouth and his eyes scrunched as he tries to see a unitary enough notebook to write in, Gately's mother on the floor, trying to crawl off toward the lockable bathroom, quietly enough, so the MP wouldn't notice her again. The Wraith says, just to give Gately an idea, he, the Wraith, in order to appear as visible and interface with him, Gately, he, the Wraith, has been sitting, still as a root, in the chair by Gately's bedside for the Wraith equivalent of 3 weeks, which Gately can't even imagine. It occurs to Gately that none of the people that have dropped by to tell him their troubles has bothered to say how many days he's even been in the trauma wing now, or what day it's going to be when the sun comes up. And so Gately has no idea how long he's gone now without an AA meeting. Gately wishes his sponsor, ferocious Francis G., would hobble by, instead of Ennett staff that want to talk about prostheses, and residents who come just to share remembered wreckage with somebody they don't even think can even hear them, sort of the way a little kid confides to a dog. He doesn't let himself even contemplate why no finest or federally crew-cut guys have visited yet, if he's been in here a while. If they've been all over the house like hamsters on wheat already, as Thrust had said. The seated shadow of somebody in a hat is still there, out there in the hall. Though if the whole interlude was a dream, it isn't and has never been there, Gately realizes, squinting a little to try to make sure the shadow is the shadow of a hat and not a fire extinguisher box on the hall wall or something. The Wraith excuses himself and disappears, but then reappears 2 slow blinks later, back in the same position. That was worth an excuse me, Gately thinks at the Wraith, dryly, almost laughing. The sheet of pain from the near laugh sent his eyes way up, back up in his head. The chassis of the heart monitor doesn't look broad enough to support even a Wraith's ass. The heart monitor is the silent kind. It's got the moving white line, with big speed bumps moving across it for Gately's pulse, but it doesn't make the sterile beeping that old hospital drama monitors did. Patients in hospital dramas were frequently unconscious figurants, Gately reflects. The Wraith says he just paid a small, quantumish call to the old spotless Brighton two-decker of one ferocious Francis Gahaney. And from the way the old crocodile's shaving and putting on a clean white T-shirt, the Wraith says, he predicts FF will be visiting the trauma wing soon, to offer Gately unconditional empathy and fellowship and acerbic crocodilian counsel. Unless this was just Gately himself thinking this up to keep a stiff upper attitude, Gately thinks. The Wraith pushes his glasses up sadly. You never think of a wraith looking sad or unsad, but this dream wraith displays the whole affective range. Gately can hear the horns and raised voices and U-turn squeals way down below on Washington that indicate it's around 00:00, the switching hour. He wonders what something as brief as a car horn honk sounds like to a figurant that has to sit still for 3 weeks to be seen. A wraith, not figurant, Gately meant, he corrects himself. He's lying here correcting his thoughts, like he was talking. He wonders if his brain voice talks fast enough for the wraith not to have to, like, tap its foot and look at its watch between words. Are they words, if they're only in your head, though? The wraith blows its nose in a hanky that's visibly seen better epochs, and says he, the wraith, when alive in the world of animate men, had seen his own personal youngest offspring, a son, the one most like him, the one most marvelous and frightening to him, becoming a figurant toward the end. His end, not the son's end, the wraith clarifies. Gately wonders if it offends the wraith when he sometimes refers to it, mentally, as it. The wraith opens and examines the used hanky just like an alive person can never help but do, and says, "No horror on earth or elsewhere could equal watching your own offspring open his mouth and have nothing come out." The wraith says it mars the memory of the end of his animate life, this son's retreat to the periphery of life's frame. The wraith confesses that he had, at one time, blamed the boy's mother for his silence. "But what good does that kind of thing do?" he said, making a blurred motion that might have been shrugging. Gately remembers the former Navy MP telling Gately's mother why it was her fault he lost his job at the chowder plant. "Resentment is the number one offender," is another Boston AA cliché Gately'd started to believe. That blame's a shell game. Not that he wouldn't mind a private couple of minutes alone, in a doorless room with Randy Lentz, once he was up, and capable again, though. The wraith reappears, slumped back in the chair with his weight on his tailbone and his legs crossed in that Erdetti-ish upscale way. He says, "Just imagine the horror of spending your whole, itinerant, lonely, Southwest and West Coast boyhood trying unsuccessfully to convince your father that you even existed, to do something well enough to be heard and seen, but not so well that you became just a screen for his own, the dad's, projections of his own failure and self-loathing, failing ever to be really seen, gesturing wildly through the distilled haze, so that in adulthood you still carried the moist, flabby weight of your failure ever to make him hear you really speak. Carried it on through the animate years on your increasingly slumped shoulders, only to find, near the end, that your very own child had himself become blank, indent, silent, frightening, mute. That is, that his son had become what he, the wraith, had feared as a child he, the wraith, was." Gately's eyes roll up in his head. "The boy, who did everything well, and with a natural unslumped grace the wraith himself had always lacked, and whom the wraith had been so terribly eager to see, and hear, and let him, the son, know he was seen and heard, the son had become a steadily more and more hidden boy toward the wraith's life's end. And no one else in the wraith and boy's nuclear family would see or acknowledge this, the fact that the graceful and marvelous boy was disappearing right before their eyes. They looked, but did not see his invisibility. And they listened, but did not hear the wraith's warning." Gately has that slight, tight, absent smile again. "The wraith says the nuclear family had believed he, the wraith, was unstable, and was confusing the boy with his own, the wraith's, boyhood self, or with the wraith's father's father, the blank wooden man who, according to family mythology, had driven the wraith's father to the bottle, and unrealized potential, and an early cerebral hemorrhage. Toward the end, he'd begun privately to fear that his son was experimenting with substances." The wraith keeps having to push its glasses up. The wraith says, almost bitterly,
that when he'd stand up and wave his arms for them all to attend to the fact that his youngest and most promising son was disappearing, they thought all his agitation meant was that he had gone bats from wild turkey intake and needed to try to get sober again one more time. This gets Gately's attention. Here, at last, could be some sort of point to the unpleasantness and confusion of the dream. "You tried to get sober?" he thinks, rolling his eyes over to the wraith. "More than once you tried? Was it white knuckle?"
343.
"Did you ever surrender and come in?" The wraith feels along his long jaw and says he spent the whole, sober, last 90 days of his animate life working tirelessly to contrive a medium via which he and the muted son could simply converse. To concoct something the gifted boy couldn't simply master and move on from to a new plateau. Something the boy would love enough to induce him to open his mouth and come out, even if it was only to ask for more. Games hadn't done it. Professionals hadn't done it. Impersonation of professionals hadn't done it. His last resort? Entertainment. Make something so bloody compelling, it would reverse thrust on a young self's fall into the womb of solipsism. Anhedonia. Death in life. A magically entertaining toy to dangle at the infant still somewhere alive in the boy, to make its eyes light and toothless mouth open unconsciously, to laugh, to bring him out of himself, as they say. The womb could be used both ways. A way to say, "I am so very